showed up for work on the day of the march. That many blacks, in one place, who knew what might happen? Even the ordinarily liberal New York Times was wary. There was great fear there would be rioting, recalled the New York Times's Russell Baker, who was assigned a front-page feature on the march. So the Times chartered a chopper. Boarding the helicopter early in the day, Baker grew so bored by the peaceable spectacle that he asked the pilot to fly over his house so he could check on the condition of his roof. "Finally," said Baker, "I had him land at National Airport and went to the Lincoln Memorial." It was, it turned out, not only orderly, but also integrated. Bob Dylan, Charlton Heston, and Marlon Brando were there. Baker took note of the series of speeches and songs, including Mahalia Jackson's "I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned," a spiritual delivered with such power that Baker reported Jackson's voice seemed to echo off the far-off Capitol. Speaker after speaker, the young John Lewis, the aged A. Philip Randolph, made the case for racial justice. For many, the day seemed an adventure, a long outing in the late summer sun, part liberation from home, part Sunday school picnic, part political convention, and part fish fry, James Reston wrote in his piece for the Times the next day. In the White House, JFK heard some of the speeches and chants through an open window of the third-floor White House solarium, the historian Michael Beschloss wrote. Gripping the windowsill, he told the mansion's courtly black doorman, Preston Bruce, "Oh, Bruce, I wish I were out there with them." But not enough to risk appearing at an event that Kennedy believed would alienate many white voters. The president watched King's speech on television, listened with appreciation, then readied for a meeting with the march's leadership to discuss pushing legislation through a Congress still dominated by white segregationist Democrats. The conversation did not produce much in the way of progress. Kennedy feared moving too quickly, and, as they had said again and again all afternoon, the civil rights delegates from the mall believed the time for action was at hand. King had anticipated Kennedy's temporizing. The pilgrimage would be long, he had told his listeners, and the pilgrims had to maintain the moral high ground they had so effectively claimed through nonviolence. "In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds," King had told the crowd. "We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline." If the politicians were too slow, well, that meant there had to be yet more dignity and yet more discipline. The Times's Reston, a reliable molder and barometer of establishment opinion, however, believed the day had in fact accomplished something, even if JFK was less than enthusiastic during the White House meeting late that afternoon. The demonstration impressed political Washington because it combined a number of things no politician can ignore, Reston wrote. It had the force of numbers. It had the melodies of both the church and the theater. And it was able to invoke the principles of the Founding Fathers to rebuke the inequalities and hypocrisies of modern American life. On that August Wednesday, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the spot on which he stood is marked there now, a sacred slab hidden in plain sight in the middle of the American Capitol, King drew from Scripture as he joined the ranks of the founders. In the beginning of the Republic, men dreamed big, but failed to include everyone in that dream, limiting liberty largely to white men. Speaking in 1963, King brilliantly argued for the expansion of the founders' vision. Nothing more, but surely nothing less. In so doing, a preacher from the South summoned a nation to justice and won his place in the American pantheon. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and every mountain shall be made low, King said. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. He paused, then pressed on. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. Transforming that hope into history remained the work of King's days. And of Lyndon Johnson's. In the months after the Kennedy assassination, the new president pressed his old colleagues on Capitol Hill to give the Civil Rights Bill a full and fair trial. President Johnson asked King to come see him in the Oval Office on Tuesday, December 3, 1963. LBJ spoke of the minutiae of reform. He needed to force the legislation out of the Southern-controlled Rules Committee in the House with a discharge petition, a device that would put the bill on the floor for a vote. Johnson was understandably consumed with the maneuver. Without it, the bill would die a procedural death. With it, progress was possible. He made it very clear he wants the Civil Rights Bill out of the Rules Committee before Christmas, King told reporters afterward. He means business. I think we can expect even more from him than we have had up to now. The day before his meeting with King, Johnson had also made himself clear in a telephone conversation with Washington Post publisher Katharine Graham. Now, every person that doesn't sign that petition has got to be fairly regarded as being anti-civil rights, Johnson had said. I don't care if he votes against the bill after he gets a chance to vote on it. But I don't think any American can say that he won't let him have a hearing, either in the committee or on the floor. That is worse than Hitler did. So we've got to get ready for that, and we've got to get ready every day. Front page, in and out, individuals, why are you against a hearing? And point them out, and have their pictures, and have editorials, and have everything else that is in a dignified way for a hearing on the floor. Johnson went to work on members of the House, and after victory there in January, when the Rules Committee forwarded the bill to the full House, and in February, when the House passed the legislation, he shifted his energies to his former colleagues in the Senate. He needed 67 votes in the upper chamber to invoke cloture and cut off the Southern-led filibuster. They tell this story about the difference between Kennedy as president and Johnson as president, recalled James H. Roe, Jr., an old FDR hand. A senator would come to Kennedy and say, I'd love to go along with you, Mr. President, but it would give me serious trouble back home. Kennedy would always say, I understand. Now, Johnson knew damn well the senator was going to tell him that, and he never let the senator get to the point of his troubles back home. He would tell him about the flag, and by God, the story of the country, and he'd get them by the lapels, and they were out the door. That's why he got so much done so fast. Roosevelt would do that too. He would do it, let's say, with more charm than Johnson, but they'd get the same results. They'd get what they wanted. Richard Russell, Jr. of Georgia, a segregationist and a Johnson mentor, appreciated his apprentice's gifts, so much so that he feared defeat for the Southern way of life at the hands of a Southern president. I have no doubt that the president intends to throw the full weight of his powerful office and the full force of his personality, both of which are considerable, to secure the passage of this program, Russell said in January 1964. From the White House, Johnson wheedled and cajoled, pressing the case again and again, rightly as it turned out, that history would reward those who voted with him. I made my position unmistakably clear. We are not prepared to compromise in any way, Johnson recalled. So far as this administration is concerned, I told a press conference, its position is firm. I wanted absolutely no room for bargaining. I knew that the slightest wavering on my part would give hope to the opposition's strategy of amending the bill to death. The president would not bend. Dick, you've got to get out of my way, Johnson told Russell. If you don't, I'm going to roll over you. I don't intend to cavil or compromise, a phrase Johnson had also used on the night of the assassination. You may do that, Russell said, but it's going to cost you the South and cost you the 1964 presidential election. If that's the price I have to pay, Johnson said, I'll pay it gladly. Which was not strictly true. Johnson never found anything gladdening about political defeat. But it says much about his commitment to doing the right thing that he was willing even to entertain the possibility of sacrificing the presidency itself for the cause of a single bill. He tasked Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota with a great deal of management of the legislation. The Republican minority leader, Everett Dirksen of Illinois, was a key player. Now, you know that this bill can't pass unless you get Ev Dirksen, Johnson told Humphrey. You and I are going to get him. You make up your mind now that you've got to spend time with Ev Dirksen. You've got to let him have a piece of the action. He's got to look good all the time. The president was emphatic. You get in there to see Dirksen. You drink with Dirksen. You talk to Dirksen. You listen to Dirksen. Johnson and his allies never gave up. We were well organized, very well organized, Humphrey recalled. We issued a daily newsletter, I think for the first time in history, that reported what had happened the day before and gave our supporters answers to the arguments of the opposition. But the main thing was that we had complete liaison at all times with the White House, with the president himself, and he answered every question, and so far as I can remember, did everything we asked, and usually a lot more, too. The president did not believe such a large legislative and cultural undertaking could be done on a partisan line vote. Unless we have the Republicans joining us and helping us, Johnson told Humphrey, we'll have a mutiny in this goddamn country, so we've got to make this an American bill and not just a Democratic bill. He used similar language in talking to Dirksen. We don't want this to be a Democratic bill, Johnson told the Republican from Illinois. We want it to be an American bill. It is going to be worthy of the land of Lincoln, and the man from Illinois is going to pass the bill, and I'm going to see that he gets proper credit. Finally, in the early summer of 1964, Johnson won the cloture vote to shut down the segregationist filibuster of the Civil Rights Bill in the Senate. It's just a miracle, Robert Kennedy remarked to Johnson. But it wasn't really. It was the result of incredibly intense work by the president to force the triumph of hope and history over political calculation and fear. There was a glorious feeling about it. There really was, recalled Ramsey Clark, a Kennedy-Johnson Justice Department official. It just seemed like there was immense generosity in the American people and goodwill, and they were going to do something about this great wrong. One Southern member of the House, Congressman Charles Weltner, a Democrat from Atlanta, changed his initial nay to a yay on the final bill. I would urge that we at home now move on to the unfinished task of building a new South, Weltner said. We must not forever be bound to another lost cause. President Johnson could not have put it better. He signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in the East Room on Thursday, July 2nd. 2 days later, on the 4th, Robert Kennedy called Johnson at the president's ranch. "Well, listen, we had a good day," Kennedy said. "Good," Johnson said. "I think that the most significant thing is that the Chamber of Commerce in Jackson, Mississippi, voted last night to abide by the law," Kennedy said, "and the vote was 16-1. "Good," said Johnson. "That's wonderful." "Yeah, and then Savannah, Atlanta, and all these cities went along. Birmingham, Montgomery, and a lot of the cities went along very, very well." Johnson was pleased, but he knew, too, that it was a battle, not the war. "I want you to write me the goddamnedest, toughest Voting Rights Act that you can devise," Johnson told Nicholas Katzenbach of the Justice Department. He made the same point to Hubert Humphrey, who would soon become Johnson's vice president. He used to tell me, "Yes, yes, Hubert, I want all those other things, buses, restaurants, all of that. But the right to vote with no ifs, ands, or buts, that's the key," Humphrey recalled of Johnson. "When the Negroes get that, they'll have every politician, north and south, east and west, kissing their ass, begging for their support." On the 1964 bill, Johnson had risen to the occasion created by the voices of protest, had, in fact, surpassed the occasion. And he knew that he and his party would pay a political price. "It is an important gain," Johnson told Bill Moyers after signing the 1964 law. "But I think we just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come." In the hour of victory, he had done something of a scale no president since Lincoln had seriously attempted to do. Johnson suffered a fairly common fate: gloom amid the grandeur of achievement. "Nothing except a battle lost," Wellington once remarked, "can be half so melancholy as a battle won." He mused for a time about bowing out of the 1964 presidential campaign and retiring to Texas. "You are as brave a man as Harry Truman, or FDR, or Lincoln," Mrs. Johnson, addressing her husband as "beloved," wrote him in this period. "You have been strong, patient, determined beyond any words of mine to express. I honor you for it. So does most of the country. To step out now would be wrong for your country, and I can see nothing but a lonely wasteland for your future." Johnson remained in the fight. The presidency seemed to be everything, or close to it, to him, and he believed it could be everything, or close to it, for the nation as well. In the first week of June, 1963, in a recorded telephone call with Kennedy counsel and speechwriter Theodore C. Sorensen, Johnson, then the vice president, had pressed Sorensen on the need for President Kennedy to make an explicit statement of support for civil rights, ideally in the South. Kennedy, Johnson told Sorensen, should say something like this: "We're all Americans. We got a golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now, I'm leader of this country. When I order men into battle, I order the men without regard to color. They carry our flag into foxholes. The Negro can do that. The Mexican can do it. Others can do it. We've got to do the same thing when we drive down the highway at places they eat. I'm going to have to ask you all to do this thing. I'm going to have to ask the Congress to say that we'll all be treated without regard to our race." Johnson said that he was certain such candor would be worth it. "I believe that he'd run some of the demagogues right in the hole," Johnson said of Kennedy. The key thing, LBJ believed, was to make the moral case for racial justice so self-evident that the country could not help but agree. "Then a man is put in the position almost where he's a bigot to be against the president," Johnson told Sorensen. "This aura, this thing, this halo around the president, Everybody wants to believe in the president and the commander-in-chief. The good people, the church people, I think, have to come around to him. Not the majority of them, maybe, but a good many of them over the country. I'm telling you, they'd be out there by the hundreds of thousands. Major civil rights progress was possible, Johnson said, and only the president could successfully press the message. I think the presidency can get it for him, LBJ said, still referring to Kennedy. I have spoken from Milwaukee to Chicago to New York to Los Angeles to Illinois last night, and Gettysburg and Dallas and Johnson City, Texas, and I think that I know one thing, that the Negroes are tired of this patient stuff and tired of this piecemeal stuff, and what they want more than anything else is not an executive order or legislation. They want a moral commitment that he's behind them. Proud of his own remarks at Gettysburg, where he had spoken out in favor of civil rights the week before on Memorial Day, the vice president recalled other encouraging moments on the road. I've been in North Carolina this year. I've been into Florida, Johnson said. Neither place would they allow Negroes to come. I said, I'm going to come, and I'm going to talk about their constitutional rights, and I want them on the platform with me, and if you don't let them, I'm not coming, period. By God, they put them on both places, right on the platform and eating with us. Johnson was thinking about the uses of TR's bully pulpit, returning to his argument for presidential leadership. The president is the canon. You let him be on all the TV networks, just speaking from his conscience, not at a rally in Harlem, but at a place in Mississippi or Texas or Louisiana, and just have the honor guard there with a few Negroes in it. Then let him reach over and point and say, I have to order these boys into battle, in the foxholes, carrying that flag. I don't ask them what their name is, whether it's Gomez or Smith, or what color they got, what religion. If I can order them into battle, I've got to make it possible for them to eat and sleep in this country. Then everybody goes home and asks his wife, what's wrong with this? And they go to searching their conscience. Every preacher starts preaching about it. We ought to recognize that and keep them busy. In the 1964 general election campaign against Republican nominee Barry Goldwater, the conservative senator from Arizona, LBJ got the chance to act on the advice he had given Sorensen. In October, the president was due in New Orleans. His aide, Bill Moyers, passed along some advice by wire. Several people in New Orleans, including our advance men, feel the president should not refer to civil rights. The preferred term, Johnson was told, was constitutional rights. The president had other ideas. At an evening banquet at the Jung Hotel in New Orleans, Johnson said, if we are to heal our history and make this nation whole, prosperity must know no Mason-Dixon line, and opportunity must know no color line. He called for unity against the forces of fear. Now, the people that would use us and destroy us first divide us. If they divide us, they can make some hay. And all these years they have kept their foot on our necks by appealing to our animosities and dividing us. Now was the time, the president said, to rise above racism. Whatever your views are, we have a constitution, and we have a Bill of Rights, and we have the law of the land, and two-thirds of the Democrats in the Senate voted for the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, and three-fourths of the Republicans, Johnson said. I signed it, and I am going to enforce it, and I am going to observe it, and I think any man that is worthy of the high office of president is going to do the same thing. I am not going to let them build up the hate and try to buy my people by appealing to their prejudice. In his memoirs, Johnson recalled that the applause was less than overwhelming, but I was in it, and I had to continue. I wanted the whole nation to know how profoundly animosity and hatred waste the common effort and dissipate the common energy. He could, he recalled, only say what I deeply believed. I spoke off the cuff and from the heart. An old Democratic senator from the South, Johnson told the New Orleans audience, had been chatting one evening with Sam Rayburn, then a young congressman from Texas. Though Johnson did not name him in the speech, he was referring to Senator Joe Bailey Sr., who was raised in Mississippi and represented Texas in the House and in the Senate. He was talking about how we had been at the mercy of certain economic interests and how they had exploited us, Johnson recalled, and he said, "Sammy, I would like to go back down there and make them one more Democratic speech. I just feel like I have one in me. The poor old state, they haven't heard a Democratic speech in 30 years. All they ever hear at election time is, 'Negra, Negra, Negra.'" The crowd was shocked and then rose to give the president a prolonged ovation. Many of his most acerbic critics have affirmed that this was Johnson's finest hour. The historian William E. Luchtenberg wrote, "There was no way a Northerner could have delivered that speech and had it carry the same meaning. Johnson had done what he had come to do. Determined to preach the gospel of inclusion in the segregated South, he had done so, he recalled, not in New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, but in New Orleans, near home, in my own backyard." In November, LBJ won a full presidential term in his own right, with 61.1% of the popular vote, in a 44-state landslide. Goldwater took just 6 states. Though, with the exception of Arizona, Goldwater's victories all came in the old Confederacy and included Louisiana, where Johnson had made his impassioned plea for civil rights. No matter the margin, Johnson could not remain still. "I've just been elected, and right now we'll have a honeymoon with Congress," the president told his staff. "But after I make my recommendations, I'm going to start to lose the power and authority I have. Every day that I'm in office, and every day I push my program, I'll be losing part of my ability to be influential, because that's in the nature of what the president does. He uses up capital. Something is going to come up, something like the Vietnam War or something else, where I will begin to lose all that I have now. So I want you guys to get off your asses and do everything possible to get everything in my program passed as soon as possible, before the aura and the halo that surround me disappear." Just as he had wooed Dirksen the previous year, Johnson reached out to Congressman Gerald Ford of Michigan, the new House Republican leader. "I don't want to start out fighting with you, because I'm not running for re-election," a debatable proposition in 1965, Johnson told Ford. "I'm just trying to make a good president, and I want you to help me. I thought you could support me when you thought it was right, and be proud of it." King marked his 36th birthday on Friday, January 15, 1965, and the President of the United States called to wish him the best. Voting rights, which were routinely denied to blacks in the South, were top of mind for Johnson. "There is not going to be anything, Doctor, as effective as all black citizens voting," Johnson told King. "That will give you a message that all the eloquence in the world won't bring. For votes meant the powerful and a candidate aspiring to power will be coming to you then instead of you calling him." King and his colleagues in the movement understood, and they had launched a voting rights drive in Alabama in the first days of 1965. The flashpoint? Selma, Alabama, the seat of Dallas County. On Sunday, March 7, 1965, a voting rights march from Selma to Montgomery had barely begun when Alabama state troopers charged a line of nonviolent demonstrators. trapped between asphalt and his uniformed attackers at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, inhaling tear gas and reeling from two billy club blows to his head, John Lewis, then 25 years old, felt everything dimming. He could hear screams and racial slurs and the clop, clop, clop of the troopers' horses. His skull fractured, his vision blurred. Lewis believed the end had come. "People are going to die here," he said to himself. "I'm going to die here." Yet for Lewis, there was, strangely, no sense of panic, no gasping, no thrashing, no fear. He was at peace. The world around him on that day, though, was at war, and the television cameras were whirring. Images of the Alabama troopers' attack on Lewis and his fellow marchers ran that evening. ABC broke into the network broadcast premiere of Judgment at Nuremberg to show the footage. What had begun as an ordinary day in a small southern city was soon to be known as Bloody Sunday, and the scene at the bridge became that rarest of things, a crossroads in the long story of civilization. Lewis's was a vision of nonviolent social change that has more in common with the martyrs of old than with the politics of a given hour. "At the moment when I was hit on the bridge and began to fall," Lewis recalled, "I really thought it was my last protest, my last march. I thought I saw death, and I thought, it's okay, it's all right, I am doing what I am supposed to do," which was to dramatize the injustice of segregation and to call white America to redemption, not through violence, but through witness. Born in 1940 to sharecropper parents, Lewis overcame a childhood stutter by preaching to chickens on the family farm in Pike County, Alabama. After the Montgomery bus boycott catapulted King to fame, Lewis sought out the emerging civil rights icon, became chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and began a fabled life in the movement. Lewis was beaten and arrested across the South, including on the epical Freedom Rides, spoke at the March on Washington in 1963, and was leading the Selma to Montgomery voting rights effort when he and Hosea Williams crested the Pettus Bridge and spotted the line of troopers on that March Sunday. Lewis had prepared to be arrested. In his backpack, he carried two books, an apple and an orange, and a toothbrush and toothpaste. Then he heard the commander's order, "Troopers, advance!" He has always remembered the enormity, the totality, of the reaction of his attackers. The troopers and posse men swept forward as one, like a human wave, a blur of blue shirts and billy clubs and bullwhips, Lewis wrote in his affecting memoir of the movement, Walking with the Wind. "We had no chance to turn and retreat. The pain was to be endured. There was no help for it." Lewis made it back to Brown Chapel AME, the Selma church that served as the headquarters for the march, and was eventually persuaded to go to a local emergency room. He still remembers the ambient smell of tear gas from the clothes of the victims seeking medical attention. For Lewis, the civil rights struggle always centered on whether the best of the American soul, the grace and the love, the godliness and the generosity, could finally win out over the worst, the racism and the hatred, the fear and the cruelty. In the end, after the marches and the beatings and the riots, the light has largely triumphed over the dark. "I always felt growing up that in the South there was evil, but also good. So much good," Lewis said. "We are still in the process of becoming. I am very, very hopeful about the American South. I believe that we will lead America to what Dr. King called the beloved community. I travel all the time, but when I come back to the South, I see such progress. In a real sense, a great deal of the South has been redeemed. People feel freer, more complete, more whole, because of what happened in the movement. He is a preacher still, one whose voice, trained so long ago in the farmyard, continues to captivate. The March of 1965 injected something very special into the soul and the heart and the veins of America, Lewis said. It said, in effect, that we must humanize our social and political and economic structure. When people saw what happened on that bridge, there was a sense of revulsion all over America. Revulsion, then redemption. In the final analysis, we are one people, one family, one house. Not just the house of black and white, but the house of the South, the house of America, Lewis said. We can move ahead. We can move forward. We can create a multiracial community, a truly democratic society. I think we're on our way there. There may be some setbacks, but we are going to get there. We have to be hopeful. Never give up. Never give in. Keep moving on. As images from the beatings at Selma spread around the nation, Johnson knew he needed to act, but he was careful. To lash out at Governor Wallace and the power structure in Alabama too hard might create more problems than it solved. If I just send in federal troops with their big black boots, it will look like Reconstruction all over again, Johnson said privately. I will lose every moderate, not just in Alabama, but all over the South. Most Southern people don't like this violence. They know deep in their hearts that things are going to change, but not if it looks like the Civil War all over again. Working through his friend, Buford Ellington, a once-and-future Tennessee governor, Johnson got Wallace to agree to come to the White House for a meeting. It was a classic LBJ encounter. The president seated Wallace on a couch in the Oval Office and then positioned himself in a taller rocking chair, dominating the smaller man. I kept my eyes directly on the governor's face the entire time, Johnson recalled. I saw a nervous, aggressive man, a rough, shrewd politician who had managed to touch the deepest chords of pride as well as prejudice among his people. Wallace, the looming Johnson said, could take care of all this trouble in a heartbeat. Why don't you just desegregate all your schools? Johnson asked. You and I go out there in front of those television cameras right now, and you announce you've decided to desegregate every school in Alabama. Oh, Mr. President, I can't do that, Wallace said. You know the schools have got school boards. They're locally run. I haven't got the political power to do that. Don't you shit me, George Wallace, Johnson said. Later in the meeting, the president pressed a larger question. George, why are you doing this? Johnson asked. You came into office a liberal. You spent all your life trying to do things for the poor. Now, why are you working on this? Why are you off on this Negro thing? You ought to be down there calling for help for Aunt Susie in the nursing home. He described the Great Society, the broad Johnson program on health care, education, and poverty. Everything seemed possible. Why not get on board? Now, listen, George. Don't think about 1968, Johnson said. Think about 1988. You and me will be dead and gone then, George. What do you want left after you when you die? Do you want a great big marble monument that reads, George Wallace, he built? Or do you want a little piece of scrawny pine board lying across that harsh caliche soil that reads, George Wallace, he hated? Wallace surrendered. Under pressure from the president, the governor consented to maintain order when the march resumed. Hell, if I'd stayed in there much longer, Wallace remarked, he'd have had me coming out for civil rights. The marchers would be protected. The President of the United States had prevailed. The meeting with Wallace was held at midday on Saturday, March 13, 1965. 2 days later, on the evening of Monday, March 15, Lyndon Johnson entered the chamber of the House of Representatives with a purposeful stride. He did not pause to shake many hands as he walked to the well. He had work to do. Standing at the rostrum with Vice President Humphrey and Speaker of the House John McCormick behind him, the President opened a folder. The address had been written on deadline by Richard Goodwin, and began to speak. He did so slowly. Johnson's public cadences could be unctuous, even ponderous, as he sought to infuse his public rhetoric with solemnity. Tonight, the tone was just right. He seemed, for once for a public man, free from political calculation or pragmatic consideration. "I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy," Johnson said. "I urge every member of both parties, Americans of all religions and of all colors, from every section of this country, to join me in that cause." He went on. "At times, history and fate meet at a single time in a single place to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. In our time, we have come to live with moments of great crisis. Our lives have been marked with debate about great issues, issues of war and peace, issues of prosperity and depression. But rarely in any time does an issue lay bare the secret heart of America itself. Rarely are we met with a challenge, not to our growth or abundance, our welfare or our security, but rather to the values and the purposes and the meaning of our beloved nation. The issue of equal rights for American Negroes is such an issue. And should we defeat every enemy, should we double our wealth and conquer the stars and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a nation. For with a country, as with a person, what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Here, for the first time, the lawmakers and guests were moved from reverie to applause. The evocation of Scripture, Johnson was quoting the words of Jesus from the Gospel of St. Mark, resonated. The President continued, "There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem. And we are met here tonight as Americans, not as Democrats or Republicans. We are met here as Americans to solve that problem." This was the first nation in the history of the world to be founded with a purpose. The great phrases of that purpose still sound in every American heart, North and South. "All men are created equal. Government by consent of the governed. Give me liberty or give me death." Well, those are not just clever words, or those are not just empty theories. Many of the issues of civil rights are very complex and most difficult. But about this there can and should be no argument. Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote. Yet the harsh fact is that in many places in this country, men and women are kept from voting simply because they are Negroes. Every device of which human ingenuity is capable has been used to deny this right. The Negro citizen may go to register only to be told that the day is wrong, or the hour is late, or the official in charge is absent. And if he persists, and if he manages to present himself to the registrar, he may be disqualified because he did not spell out his middle name, or because he abbreviated a word on the application. And if he manages to fill out an application, he is given a test. The registrar is the sole judge of whether he passes this test. He may be asked to recite the entire Constitution, or explain the most complex provisions of state law, and even a college degree cannot be used to prove that he can read and write. For the fact is that the only way to pass these barriers is to show a white skin. What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it is not just Negroes, but really it is all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome. On the night of the speech to Congress, King called Johnson, who was back in the White House. "It is ironic, Mr. President," King said, "that after a century, a Southern white president would help lead the way toward the salvation of the Negro." "Thank you, Reverend," Johnson said. "You're the leader who is making it all possible. I'm just following along, trying to do what's right." "It is difficult to fight for freedom," Johnson said as he signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in August. "But I also know how difficult it can be to bend long years of habit and custom to grant it. There is no room for injustice anywhere in the American mansion, but there is always room for understanding toward those who see the old ways crumbling. And to them today, I say simply this: it must come. It is right that it should come." An echo of Lincoln, perhaps inadvertent, but nonetheless telling. Lincoln had spoken of the tragedy of the Civil War, and the war came. Johnson now spoke of progress, of a brighter day. It must come. No one in the loop, including, almost surely, the man himself, knew whether he'd really do it. On Sunday, March 31st, 1968, President Johnson was scheduled to address the nation about the Vietnam War at 9 p.m. He had a draft of a short section for the end of the speech, announcing that he would not seek re-election in November. The president had talked about it with family and a few advisers, but the circle of trust was small after more than 4 years of tumult and war, and Johnson wanted to keep his options open. At one point that Sunday, Johnson stopped in his aide Marvin Watson's office to talk about the race with Terry Sanford, the former North Carolina governor who had agreed to manage the 1968 campaign. After spending all day at the White House, Johnson advisor John P. Roche recalled, "Terry Sanford left for the airport still under the impression that he was the campaign manager." Only a few hours later, on television, Johnson withdrew, solemnly drawling, "I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president." Roche couldn't believe it. "I had already put an LBJ 68 bumper sticker on my car," he said, "and I was wearing an LBJ 68 button. We were left with 15,000 of the goddamn things." The watershed of 1968 was that kind of year, one of surprises and reversals, of blasted hopes and rising fears, of scuttled plans and unexpected new realities. The year began with Tet and cascaded into chaos, the deaths of King and of Robert Kennedy, the riots that engulfed many American cities, the calamitous Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and finally, wearily, the election of Richard Nixon as the nation's 37th president. More than 500,000 U.S. troops were in Vietnam, and combat deaths occurred at a rate of about 46 U.S. troops a day, for a total of 16,899 that year. It was a period of disorienting violence, of disorder, of loss, of pervasive tragedy. The setting was splendid. The congregation rapt, the preacher at ease. On the morning of the same day Johnson made his evening announcement about withdrawing from the 1968 campaign, Martin Luther King was in Washington to offer a Lenten sermon at the National Cathedral. Easter was 2 weeks away, but King's mind was more on the world beyond the cathedral's splendid stained glass than it was on the details of the Christian calendar. Standing in the ornate Canterbury pulpit, gazing out across the sprawling nave, King summoned his listeners to the hard work of the gospel. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, King said, and whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it is structured. He would be dead before the week was out. History was moving quickly as King preached amid the hymns and the psalms of the Episcopal liturgy. In the shadow of the Hilltop Cathedral, Johnson was preparing for his evening address to the nation. And by the time Sunday worshipers gathered again in the sacred space of the National Cathedral, King would be martyred by an assassin's bullet outside room 306 at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. King's earthly journey thus ended, as his public life had begun back in Montgomery, at the uneasy but essential intersection of faith, politics, and history. His was a life lived between different, though sometimes overlapping, worlds, of black and white, of good and evil, of the kingdom of men and the kingdom of heaven. Buffeted by the demands of the present, King bore witness to a message that was, in St. Augustine's phrase, ever ancient, ever new, an insistence that the testimony of the prophets and the example of Christ could march from the past into what King called the fierce urgency of now in order to liberate the future. King was not perfect, but then no man is. To know him is to know American history. From the bus boycott in Montgomery to the showdowns in Birmingham, from the I Have a Dream speech to the struggle for voting rights in Selma, from his anti-poverty, poor people's campaign to his opposition to the Vietnam War, King spoke with the voice of a prophet, urging a nation to repent and return to righteousness. The movement was about much more than King, but it's a recurrent fact of history that human beings seek apostles who embody widely shared creeds. And in the battle against Jim Crow and for economic justice in the 1950s and 60s, King was that apostle, and he will be a source of fascination and veneration as long as the American story is told. In that last Sunday sermon in Washington in 1968, King spoke of America and of her obligations. To whom much is given, the scriptures tell us, much is expected, of individuals and of nations. One day we will have to stand before the God of history, and we will talk in terms of things we've done, King preached. Yes, we will be able to say we built gargantuan bridges to span the seas. We built gigantic buildings to kiss the skies. Yes, we made our submarines to penetrate oceanic depths. we brought into being many other things with our scientific and technological power. It was a message that united politics and faith. King continued, "It seems that I can hear the God of history saying, 'That was not enough. But I was hungry, and ye fed me not. I was naked, and ye clothed me not. I was devoid of a decent sanitary house to live in, and ye provided no shelter for me. And consequently, you cannot enter the kingdom of greatness. If ye do it unto the least of these, my brethren, ye do it unto me.'" That's the question facing America today. By Thursday evening, King was dead. When Johnson learned of King's assassination, he telephoned Coretta Scott King and appealed to the country for calm. The next day, Friday, April 5th, the president attended a memorial service for the slain King at the National Cathedral. On returning to the White House, Johnson announced a national day of mourning. "The dream of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.," the president said, "has not died with him." On the road in Indianapolis on the evening King was shot, Robert Kennedy, who was seeking the Democratic presidential nomination, learned about the assassination from R.W. Appel, Jr. of the New York Times. Wearing an overcoat that had belonged to his brother, Jack, RFK broke the news to an inner-city crowd. "What we need in the United States," he said, "is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black." Even then, the fates were not yet satisfied. In April, Jacqueline Kennedy had shared a premonition of disaster. "Do you know what I think will happen to Bobby?" she asked Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. "The same thing that happened to Jack. There is so much hatred in this country." She was proved correct in June, when RFK was gunned down in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, after winning the California primary. Back in the ballroom, a woman screamed, "No, God, no! It's happened again!" The fear that the world was out of balance helped Richard Nixon, who had only narrowly lost to John F. Kennedy 8 years earlier, prevail, also narrowly, in November against Hubert Humphrey. The dynamics of the 68 campaign resonate still. Nixon, advised among others by Roger Ailes, who would go on to found the Fox News Channel, campaigned on a cultural populism, arguing that elites and implying that minorities were undercutting American greatness. That November, running on a third-party ticket, George Wallace carried 13.5% of the popular vote nationally and won 5 states. Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia, Arkansas, and Mississippi, giving him 46 electoral votes. It was not a bad starting point for a subsequent populist candidate who would tell voters that walls and tariffs would bring back the America they thought they had once known. At noon on Monday, January 20th, 1969, Richard Nixon stood on the east portico of the Capitol to take the oath of office as the nation's 37th president. To the side, wearied by an inconclusive war in Southeast Asia and exhausted from the toil of seeking to build a great society at home, Lyndon Johnson found his mind ranging widely. "The magnitude of the job dwarfs every man who aspires to it," Johnson recalled in his memoirs. "Every man who occupies the position